Brad Meltzer is 38 and the author of 6 best-selling suspense novels. They're what you might call potboilers or page-turners, and they include The Tenth Justice, The First Counsel, The Book of Fate. His latest book is The Book of Lies. One thread running through Meltzer's work is detailed research. He weaves in real events, locations, and life experiences. This time, he writes about the origins of that American comic book character, Superman. I asked Meltzer how he came up with the Superman story.
The story actually found me. I was at a book signing 2 years ago, and a woman stands up and says to me, "I know more about Superman than you'll ever know." And I think to myself, "Lady, there is no way you know more about Superman than I know." And she says, "Sure I do." She said, "Jerry Siegel, who created Superman, is my uncle." And she's the one who introduces me and takes me into the entire family and unveils to me this unsolved murder from 1932 that nobody knows about. I mean, it's known in a couple geek circles, but nobody knows this story. Because in 50 years of interviews, when they ask Jerry Siegel, "Where'd you get the idea for Superman?" he never tells anybody that his father died in a robbery. You create the world's greatest crime fighter right after your father dies in a crime and you never tell anybody? And that's why the world got Superman, not because America's the greatest country on earth, but because a little boy lost his father.
Now, Mitchell Siegel was a haberdasher. Tell me about the circumstances of his death.
Yeah, the circumstances of his death, it depends who you ask. Half the family is told that he works in this haberdasher, that he's a tailor, and that someone comes in, pulls a gun, takes some clothes, and shoots him in the chest. The other entire half of the family will tell you that a man comes in, pulls a gun, asks for some clothes, but that Mitchell Siegel has a heart attack. There is no shooting. There is no blood. To this day, it doesn't matter whether he died of a heart attack or whether he died of a shooting. What matters is that Jerry Siegel's father died in a robbery. He died in a crime.
You know, people who follow Superman are sometimes obsessive about Superman trivia. So I'd like you to help me distinguish between the fact and the fiction involving the story now that you've actually dug into this. You went back to Cleveland. There really is a red and blue house back in Cleveland.
It's incredible. I said to myself, if I'm going to do the research for this, I need to see where Superman was created. It's in Cleveland, Ohio, and I go back to the house. I assumed it would be something out of a Norman Rockwell painting, that the apple pie would be right there on the porch. The place is a wreck, and I'm not talking about it needs a little bit of paint. It is has giant holes in the wall, holes in the ceiling. It's painted bright blue and red, real Superman colors. This is absolutely...
Who painted it, these colors?
The owners, I think, who are currently there, painted it Superman colors years ago. And you can't miss it. It's a rough place.
There are also interesting details in the story. There's one in particular that I loved. There's a search for a weapon. And someone goes into a series of fast food restaurants, and they go straight to the men's room, and then they sort of feel around inside the ceiling tiles looking for a firearm. And after a series, I think it's 4 or maybe 5 restaurants, they finally move a ceiling tile and they find one. And you write, "It's hardly a perk of my job, but it's the same in every crap neighborhood in America. Show me a local fast food joint and I'll show you where the kids are hiding their guns." Did you make this up, or is this something you tripped upon in your research?
No, I didn't make it up. That's absolutely true. I went out with homeless outreach workers, and I said, "I need to know how your job works." And I said, where do you find weapons? Where do people hide weapons? And they said, "Oh, go to Burger King. Go to any Burger King, go to any McDonald's in a bad neighborhood, go into the bathroom, push up the ceiling tile and feel around, and eventually you're going to find a gun. Because these kids can't bring them to school, they won't bring them home, and they need someplace to hide them." Put it right in the book.
Brad, when you talk about Superman, I see in here not just a 38-year-old man, but some shadings of an 8-year-old boy. You loved Superman, didn't you?
I loved Superman. I loved Batman. Anyone who loves these characters loves them from when they're a child. And I know that part of this is just me in some vain attempt to regain hair and youth. But it's what I love. And I don't love it because I just want to play with my action figures and sit in the corner and read my books like I used to. I love them because of what they say about us. The first morality tales we ever read are superhero comics. That's where you first see whether the good guys win and whether the bad guys win. And it matters. It shapes us as a society. If you look back at the Great Depression and you look at which comic strips were popular, they were Flash Gordon and Tarzan, characters designed to transport us elsewhere. It was the Depression. No one wanted to be in the reality. And then here comes World War II, America's scared and terrified, and suddenly Superman arrives, ready to save us all, takes off. Now, here go, we are in 9/11. Remember the first big blockbuster after 9/11? It was Spider-Man. Once again, we're a country that's terrified and we want someone to save us. Now look who we've nominated for the President of the United States. We haven't nominated politicians. We're looking for heroes. McCain is someone who has fought the bad guys with his bare hands. Obama is someone who's the great hope to half of America. This is all not coincidence. We are starving for heroes.
Brad Meltzer, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Brad Meltzer's latest book is called The Book of Lies.
Our book reviewer, Alan Chews, believes there's nothing more harrowing than a good old-fashioned murder mystery. Nothing except for two of them. And with these new novels, he found what he was looking for.
Harrowing is the best way to describe Donald Farr's new novel, A Common Ordinary Murder. Harrowing and somehow exultant at the same time. The main character is Police Lieutenant Stephen McCord, a district commander in a fairly large, unnamed Midwestern city. On McCord's radar is a particularly brutal murder of an elderly political activist and the ghastly rape and murder of the man's daughter. Lieutenant McCord painstakingly searches for clues and hunts for the killer or killers while his marriage seems to be falling down around him, mainly because of his own doing. His wife, Nora, is deeply Catholic. McCord himself is deeply enamored of an intensive care nurse from a local hospital. These two strands of the story work in counterpoint, and Farr's unusually philosophical approach to murder and sex and infidelity heightens the struggle almost to operatic intensity. With questions about religious faith, fidelity, wisdom, the nature of the human animal, trust, and despair on almost every page, the novel reads almost like a whodunit by the late Leo Tolstoy. If you like a little satire with your blood, I highly recommend the new novel by John Darton, a veteran New York Times reporter and editor with at least one Pulitzer Prize under his belt and many other accolades. Darton now writes novels. His latest, Black and White and Dead All Over, opens with a body on the newsroom floor of a newspaper he calls the New York Globe. This certainly can't be the New York Times, can it? The famous gray lady of American journalism, with editors and owners and reporters falling all over themselves trying to catch the killer of a much-despised assistant managing editor. It's certainly a funhouse mirror image of the Times, though. A very large cast of neatly edged newsroom characters make for a very large list of suspects, and try as I might, I couldn't identify the killer myself until the novel had almost fully unfurled. So, nothing much ordinary about this book, as Darton packs more than half a lifetime of newspaper lore into these blood-drenched pages. Now, how about this for a crime menu? Donald Farr's novel for the entree, John Darton's for dessert.
Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University. Those two novels again, A Common Ordinary Murder by Donald Farr and Black and White and Dead All Over by John Darnton.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Russia might be the land of Dostoevsky and Chekhov, but with the fall of communism came a rush of popular romance novels and thrillers which had been banned by the Soviets. In the 1990s, some Russians began to fear their country had become a literary wasteland. Now, critics of the Russian government say its turn towards authoritarianism is sparking a literary revival. NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer has our story from Moscow.
Crowds peruse new titles at a book fair held in a central Moscow art gallery. In a crowded hall, one of the country's most popular writers, Dmitry Bukov, reads from his latest book. Afterward, Bukov dismisses any accusations that Russia's great literary tradition is in peril.
Reality itself is in constant crisis. So, in that sense, the fact that people say Russian literature is in crisis is the best sign that it's actually alive and well.
In the 1990s, several new Russian writers came to prominence with books full of black humor mocking Soviet life and Russia's new wild capitalism and describing visions of a dark utopian future. Vladimir Sorokin is one of Russia's most prominent writers. At his country dacha outside Moscow, surrounded by birch trees and sporting his trademark mane of white hair and goatee, Sorokin says Russia's new authoritarianism is providing a treasure trove of subject material.
I've always been interested in exploring violence. In our society, the individual is repressed from birth.
Sorokin has just completed the sequel to his novel, Dzhenj Oprichnika, which describes Russia in the year 2027. The country has been separated from the West by a new Great Wall and is overrun by royal terror squads who indulge in gay sex and drug abuse. Sorokin says it's a metaphor for the kind of place Russia became under former President Vladimir Putin.
Once again, the authorities in the Kremlin have become completely closed off from the people. They are becoming cruel, unpredictable, and corrupt. They have taken the place of God, and they are forcing people to worship them.
Sorokin says fiction writing is one of the last remaining pursuits in Russia in which free expression is still allowed. But Sorokin has run into trouble. In 2002, members of a pro-Kremlin youth group made headlines, ripping up copies of one of his novels and throwing them into a giant toilet. Sorokin was later taken to court on charges of pornography that were subsequently dropped. Sorokin and a handful of other writers are becoming better known abroad. But Natalia Ivanova, an editor of the literary journal Znamya, says the best Russian writers are young and barely known.
Russian literature today is like a cake with many layers. We have mass, popular literature, and middle-brow literature. But we also have very good, complicated literature for the elite.
But Ivanova says even as Russia's literary scene expands, it's being threatened by a shrinking readership. Under the repression of the Soviet Union, she says, literature was the main form of escape. With the proliferation of movies and television shows today, she says, Russia is in danger of turning from a country of readers into a country of viewers. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Moscow.
I am Netta Ulabi, host of NPR's podcast, Book Tour. This week, an unusual reading from author Christian Lander. He created a website called Stuff White People Like to mock stereotypes and assumptions about race and class, and he turned it into a book.
White people spend a lot of time worrying about poor people. It takes up a pretty significant portion of their day. They feel guilty and sad that poor people shop at Walmart instead of Whole Foods, and they vote Republican instead of Democratic. That they go to community college or get a job instead of studying art in college. It is a poorly kept secret that deep down white people believe that if given money and education, all poor people would be exactly like them.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please visit npr.org/booktour.
Many things run in families: eye color, voice timbre, mannerisms, creativity. All of those things are part of David Lovelace's genetic legacy, and so was madness. Bipolar disorder affected everyone in his immediate family, save one sister. David, his brother, mother, and father each struggled alone and together, sometimes better, sometimes worse. One year, all the male Lovelaces were committed for treatment. Navigating the larger-than-life highs and lows, the many curses and occasional blessings that come with manic depression form the subject of his new memoir. David Lovelace's new book is called Scattershot, A Memoir of My Bipolar Family. He's with us today from WFCR, a member station in Amherst, Massachusetts. Nice to have you on the program with us today.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And there's a scene you describe in your book where you're trying to get your father into a hospital for much-needed treatment, and he pulls himself together to act sane in front of a police officer, and you know what he's doing because that's something you've done too.
Right. I've done it, and it's really hard work, but it can be done. I watched him as he slowed his mind down and began, he pulled himself together and started to act reasonable in a very unreasonable situation.
And this can sometimes, there's another, almost immediately thereafter, you go to an emergency room where you're again trying to get him for treatment, and you're talking with various people who are supposed to be patients' advocates, and he looks reasonable to them.
Yeah. Well, my father is a very intelligent man. I mean, he's brilliant. And he pulled it together. And I think there's a shot of adrenaline that happens when you realize you're actually getting dragged into a hospital. And it just helped him pull it off. And also, I think it's very difficult, and it should be, to commit somebody. There's a lot of checkpoints, and people want to make sure that it's necessary. You have to be a danger to yourself or to others, and you have to demonstrate that.
And you also, you as the person who's trying to get him some help, you have to explain to other people what's going on with him, and it can be extremely difficult to get people to understand.
Oh, sure. It's very difficult to describe, and in that kind of an emotional situation, it's very difficult to start talking about your father to strangers, and such an intimate and, in a lot of ways, humiliating situation.
Humiliating. Obviously, you're checking yourself in for treatment. You're accepting yourself as well, crazy, not to use too fine a point.
I've never checked myself in for treatment. I've been hospitalized twice. My father's never checked himself in for treatment. Generally, you don't want to be treated. At that point, when you're on a manic high, deep down, you know you've lost it, and you're crazy, and you're very scared. But you're on a roller coaster, and it's you're high, you know. It's an amazing moment, and you don't want anybody to stop that. You don't want to deal with the after effects of it either.
Let's see if we can get a caller in on the conversation.
Okay.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Brett. And Brett's calling us from Allegan in Michigan.
Yes, how are you doing, Neil?
Very well, thanks.
That's good. I have a lot of common ground with the caller there and the writer. I suffer from manic depression, have for about 20 years. Checked myself in, had a lithium chemical imbalance, and found that lithium didn't help.
Oh, really?
I've spent about the last 20 years without treatment, just dealing with it on my own.
Uh-huh.
You know, just with personal knowledge of what I have and recognizing the symptoms and some of the dietary challenges that can spur it and bring it on.
Dietary challenges?
Yeah, some things you eat and stuff like that can have an effect as to how the manic or the depressive side of it comes out in you.
Do you find that, David?
I mean, it's a biological disease. It's a brain disease, and it responds to things you put in your body and things you do with your body. I mean, I really need to exercise. I know that. That's part of my regimen. And my personal experience and the experience of my family is that lithium worked very well. Each person's different, but for my family, lithium was a lifesaver. But other people can't tolerate the side effects. There are other drugs that are out there that are mood stabilizers as well, like Depakote and things.
Mm-hmm. Brett, do you? Some of those are also can be difficult to their side effects.
Yeah, you know, like I say, the lithium did not give me any benefits that I really found that I couldn't deal with the manic depressive side of it better on my own. And that's one thing I was curious was if there was new advances in drugs and stuff. You know, I firmly believe that the suicide of my grandmother and my aunt were directly linked to chemical imbalances, but in those days they didn't really have a diagnosis for it as being that. You know, they both committed suicide.
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, I'm wondering. I'm just curious if your symptoms are you more on the depressive side or the manic side?
Oh no, I'm Mr. Manic.
Okay, you're zippy because I think that lithium isn't as effective on the lower end, but generally it, at least in my experience, it works well for the upper end, but. I'm telling you, eat good food and exercise. You're lucky.
Yeah.
You know, you figured out a way to deal with it.
Well, I'm a blue-collar laborer, so I channel it through energy at work.
Yeah.
I turn it into money.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm a carpenter, and it helps, you know?
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Physical activity does definitely help. a lot of the hard things was when I was younger and I had no idea what was going on was reverse emotions and things like being at funerals and stuff and not understanding why you wanted to burst into laughter.
Right.
Until I knew what was going on with it, it was really, really tough to deal with, and trying to explain it to anyone was just impossible.
Right, right.
All that inappropriate stuff, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the saddest things about the disease is that it generally hits when people are in their early 20s or young adulthood, just when you're trying to figure out what you're going to do with your life and how you're going to proceed, you get whammed with this, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Brett, good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for the call. Let's see now if we can go to, this is another David. David's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead, please.
I suffer from bipolar disorder, and I'm also schizoaffective. And one thing I find interesting is that a lot of people who suffer from mental disorder are also very creative people. I myself write poetry and I draw. And one thing I was afraid of when I first started seeking treatment is that I would lose that creativity.
David Lovelace, right. I know that's part of your concern, too.
Well, I mean, that's why I wrote the book, really. Because I knew manic depression is a very treatable disease. Generally, it's also one of the most lethal. It is the most lethal mental illnesses, but it's the most treatable. And but people shy away from treatment. They don't want to take the medicines because they're worried that it's going to cramp their creativity or kill their muse. And a lot of artists are bipolar, quite a few poets, actually. And I think that may be, in my experience, that hypomanic or manic experience of free associating and pulling things together that don't seem like they should be together is sort of part of being a poet. You know, that's your bread and butter, really.
Yeah.
And to take lithium or any mood stabilizer and squash that a bit is a profound decision. I found that I've lowered my dose to the point where I found a balance. And I sort of want to get that word out that that's possible.
Yeah, yeah, it's a compromise, though.
It is a compromise. It is a bit of a balance. I can say that without lithium, I don't think I would have been able to write this book. I wouldn't have had the focus and the attention to write 300 pages. Poets are lucky in a way they can, and I've written plenty of poetry. You can dash off a poem and then shoot off to do something else. You don't need to that sustained focus.
Right.
You can always come back and work on it again. But you lose when you're not taking care of your bipolar illness. It can run you. Hmm. But I will admit I'm proud to be bipolar, and I think it brings a lot of gifts with it as well.
David, so. Do you find that the same way?
Yes, I do. I've found that not only do I have the creativity, but I've also it gives me a better understanding of other people's emotions. It makes me more empathetic towards others.
Well, David, good luck with your poetry.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
Bye.
Thanks, David.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation, too. Terry Chaney has struggled with and written about bipolar disorder. Her book is called Manic, and she joined us by phone from Los Angeles today. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Neil. Forgive my voice. I have a little cold.
Well, I hope you feel better, but thanks for taking the time to speak with us when you get a voice. You were extremely successful. You're an agent.
I was an entertainment litigator.
Entertainment litigator and represented some very high-powered clients, yet you were able to function with, was sometimes a very debilitating disease.
Well, people don't realize that there are periods of normalcy in manic depression. You're not always manic or depressed. There is, in fact, a state called hypomania where you're very creative and very functional, very productive. So I lived in that state a lot of the time, thank God.
And how did you live in context of your family, as we're talking with David Lovelace about his family?
Well, there doesn't seem to be a history of bipolar disorder that's known in my family. Certainly, I have an older brother. He seems relatively sane, and my parents were sane. So it's unclear for me where it came from.
Have you come to terms with your illness? Do you accept it?
Do I accept it? I would say that I've come to an uneasy truth with it. I don't, you know, I'm not happy about the depressions because they're just debilitating and devastating, and no one should have to suffer like that. But there are, as David was saying, there are a lot of highs to be had, and you cherish those.
I wonder, and I'd like to ask you both about this, did writing about it in describing it, did that help at all? And Terry, let's hear first from you.
Oh, for me, it was incredibly cathartic and very difficult as well. Describing the depressions in particular were very hard. You simply don't have words for that state of mind. But it was a great release, and it gave me a lot of clarity, I think.
David, what about you?
Hi, Terry.
Hi, David.
Yeah, I've got a cold, too, actually. I right after I hospitalized my father, this was in 2005, I went through the real ringer, and I wrote a poem about it, a long poem, and I read it at a reading, and it didn't have the punch it needed. It didn't have that cathartic whack that I needed it to have. So then I sat down and I just started writing. I said, all right, well, I've been writing about this obliquely in poetry for years and years. Now I'm just going to face it head on and just describe it. And it was great. I mean, it was really it was really helpful for me. I agree. I had a harder time writing about the depression than the mania. The mania is, you know, snap, pop. There's a lot of drama in it. And the depression, there's just this dull pain, you know. So
I wonder, did you read other people's memoirs about or other people's descriptions of bipolar disorder?
Well, I assume one has read Kay Redfield Jamison. She's sort of the guru of manic depression. But
absolutely.
I think he relied more on my own experiences than I did on other people's accounts.
I wonder, David, also, you're describing your family members. What's their reaction to your description of not only your illness, but theirs?
That was the most interesting part of writing this book. Both my brother and sister are very supportive. And, you know, I showed them drafts as we went, and they added stories and a lot of back and forth, and it drew us closer. My parents, I went back and forth with my dad about it some, and he gave me some stories I didn't know. But he grew increasingly anxious about the topic. It's not something that my family's ever really spoken about openly or frankly.
Euphemism you use, the whim-whams, yeah.
Absolutely. It was the whim-whams. It was either sort of shunted into a spiritual frame, or it was the whim-whams.
Yeah, your dad was a minister and a religious historian.
Yeah, he is. So I sat down with my mom about halfway through it and just said, well, Mom, she suffers from quite a bit of anxiety. She really wrestles with depression. And I said, well, Mom, it's a loving book. But it's honest, and it looks at really difficult stuff. And, you know, read it if you want, but it's okay if you don't read it. And she was fine with that. She's decided not to read it. My father has decided not to talk about it. So that's where it stands now. We'll see what happens.
Terry Chaney, did your family read your book?
Yes, I sound a little luckier than David. It was the beginning of a dialogue for us because nobody... I didn't tell anyone a lot of the things that had happened to me, the suicide attempts, the, you know, going to jail, things that happened in my manic phases. My family was just finding out about a lot of this for the first time, and they've been very supportive, very surprisingly supportive. And I think upset that they weren't told before that we could deal with it earlier.
Well, let's get another caller on the line. Now, this is another David. A lot of Davids today. David from San Francisco.
I just wanted, my mother is a bipolar manic depressive, and she was a single mother, and because of her episodes, essentially my sister and I were placed in foster home or eventually split up across the country. And, you know, during our adolescence, there grew this deep resentment for my mother, for the illness. And I just wanted to comment on that portion. I think, you know, both my sister and I don't have the illness, but it deeply affected us. You know, I think people don't realize when parents have manic depression and they're single parents, you know, it really kind of tears apart a family.
Oh, I can understand that.
You know,
absolutely.
There's a terrific organization called NAMI, N-A-M-I, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. It's a family-based organization, and it deals with people who've had parents who are mentally ill or loved ones. And I really strongly recommend people to get in touch with it because there's a lot of healing that goes on there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
And thanks for the call, David. And David Lovelace, I wanted to ask you, when you first started to realize that you were getting like your mother, I mean, it opened just a well of emotion in you.
A well of fear. I experienced my first hardcore clinical depression when I was 16. And it was brutal. And when I finally just did my time and pulled out of it, there wasn't any talk of psychiatry or medicine. And when I got out of that, I began to fear sadness. I didn't want to experience sadness. So I sort of constructed my life in ways I tried as best I could to avoid that emotion. And that's a really, well, it's a sad thing.
it's not easy either.
No, it's not easy. It's impossible. But I think that's one of the challenges in being bipolar is that you have to learn to trust yourself, to trust your emotions, but also to be able to gauge them and find that balance.
David Lovelace, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
David Lovelace, the author of Scattershot. You can read an excerpt from the book at npr.org. He joined us from the studios of member station WFCR in Amherst. And thanks again. Terry Chaney, we hope your cold gets better.
Thank you very much.
Terry Chaney is the author of Manic, a memoir about her life with bipolar disorder, joining us by phone today from her home in Los Angeles.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.